The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Well, now we want to revisit something else that happened in Washington, D.C. That was that mid-air collision. And I'm joined now by Kevin Byrne, who's Airport and Safety and Security Auditor, retired Lieutenant Colonel. Kevin, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, let's go back to that mid-air collision,
yes,
which seemed inexplicable that it should happen, although the airspace, admittedly, very crowded.
Very crowded. And a number of facts, of course, have emerged since last week. Some of the things I said are correct and some of them are not quite as correct as I might have thought. Black Hawk Pat 25 was descending down Route 4, which is along the riverside, as you know, the Potomac. And I understand now from an air accident investigator to whom I spoke, it was descending from 1,000 feet down to the 200 feet, which is the max height allowed on that particular route. Now, why it was up at 1,000 feet, I don't know. But he was trying to get down to the altitude to pass the airport runway, as it were, in that regard. Mm. But it's a very, you know, it was a very kind of dangerous operation, I thought.
How much time did he have to get down from 1,000 feet?
As long as he took. But he should have been at 200 feet before he ever came within sight of the airport, according to the actual map I have looked at, the aeronautical chart in that regard. Also, the number of people in the tower wasn't one, it was five. There was a supervisor, a supervision person under training, one ground movements controller, the controller himself, who was a local controller, speaking to the two aircraft, and one assistant. But what I didn't know was that the two aircraft were on different frequencies, Pat, which complicates the matter no end. So one person was talking on two frequencies, which I know from experience is very hard to do.
I mean, you were an air traffic controller yourself,
years
admittedly not in the busiest airport in
the world. It got very busy, as you know, out in Baldonnel. You could have helicopters coming in east, west, north, south.
Would they always be on the same frequency?
Usually, yes, but sometimes you have two different frequencies, a ground frequency and a tower frequency. It's really hard to concentrate if you've got helicopters mixing with jet traffic. And the controller here is looking after not just one, but three aircraft, because you have the accident aircraft coming into land on 3-3, one behind it, by the way, and then the helicopter popping up on a different frequency in the same airspace. So, you know, it wasn't easy. And I suspect that the aircraft, the helicopter, Pat-25, actually took sight of the second aircraft on final approach to runway 01. So it's a complicated airspace. It's dark. Mm-hmm. They have recovered the flight recorders from both aircraft. The helicopter, Pat-25, had one on board. It's a combined voice recorder and a flight data recorder, and they're being dried out as we speak, and they will look at them. But the aircraft collisions took place at between 325 and 300 feet, so they're working out the exact altitude above the water.
Now, what they call the TCAS equipment, which is a collision avoidance.
Yes. It's switched off, Pat, in the helicopter. It is fitted as a standard in the aircraft, but if they flew past the 200 feet, they'd be conflicting with all the traffic that's, some of it on the ground and some of it in the air, so they switch it off as a matter of form going down Route 4 at 200 feet. Otherwise, it causes too much confusion, as it were.
Now, the blame will be attributed at some point, or at least explained.
Yes.
But on the face of it, you know, the pilot of the jet aircraft coming in, he doesn't have any scope to manoeuvre.
No, and in fact he has been cleared to land under a positive air traffic control, and he's making a visual approach into the runway as indicated and has done before like that, and is making, he also can't look down, by the way. All you can do is look forward at so many degrees left and right. He's in a bank, a left-hand bank, levelling off at 300 feet, or descending indeed from 300 to land on a runway which is clear to see, and the traffic, the helicopter is told to go behind him. But again, specifying an aircraft type in the dark is very, very difficult. Go behind a CRJ means little enough if you can't see which one it is, and it's flashing lights and that kind of thing.
What does CRJ stand for?
The Canadian Regional Jet. They're specifying a type of aircraft. Oh. It might have been clearer if the air traffic controller in the tower had said, aircraft on final approach to runway 33, 1 mile out, go behind. That kind of thing, you know. But look, this is
People will be wondering, why the hell didn't the guy in the chopper just hover? Because that's a capability of choppers. They don't have to proceed, whereas the jet has
that
no
is
option but to proceed.
But you see, they were positive that they knew where they were and they'd identified the traffic call to them. But I suspect it's the second item on final approach that they actually identified. Don't forget, they're wearing night vision goggles in a very highly built-up area and a well-lit area, so there can be a depth perception loss, and there's also going to be a loss of, a peripheral vision and that kind of thing.
Going back to the manning of the control tower, five people, someone under training, now that can be a distraction.
Indeed it can, and the supervisor might not be, you know, fully aware of what everything is doing, because the tower controller was highly experienced and things were going in the normal way. They weren't expecting this collision to take place. It was a busy time, but there was nothing unusual about it, and the supervisor had allowed the second person to depart the tower some time beforehand.
Now, this accident investigation, it's different to a lot of them because they're not looking for any technical faults.
No.
These were two aircraft which were
perfectly
sound.
Yes, perfectly serviceable before the collision took place. But the point I like to make about air accident investigation is not that they're pointing a finger and trying to get a blame. They're trying to put in place, you know, ameliorations that will stop it happening again. So they will investigate everything down to the nth degree, come to conclusions, have findings, and then put in place matters that will prevent it happening again. It's to stop it happening.
All right. And generally speaking, flight safety, people looking at these and the missing aircraft in Alaska, and they're wondering, is there something going on? Is aircraft safety changing?
No, it's not. It's in fact, and let's look at some figures indeed. How safe is flying, Pat, in 2024? The full figures won't be out for a couple of months yet, believe it or not. But look, we had two serious crashes, but that's all we had, really. There's a few minor ones, but in terms of commercial jet traffic, we'd one on the 25th of December, the Azerbaijan Airlines, which was hit by a missile. You know, that can't be considered an accident, yeah, in my view. I made a crash landing. And then you had the Jeju Air flight on the 29th, a few days later, and that was a serious board ingestion of two engines, and it crashed in an airport that should have been designed better. But apart from that, the recent...
Had there been a proper runoff area in that airport, the aircraft could have braked,
yes,
stopped safely.
It would have come to a halt, in my opinion. It might have caught fire, but they would have, you know, they would have evacuated under the normal circumstances. To say how safe is flying, just to get over that point, if you the global death risk in flying in commercial aircraft, commercial jets, is approximately 1 in 13.7 million. And compare that to the road safety fatality rate of the world, it's 1 in 1.19 million. So it's far, far safer to go flying than it is to go driving or cycling or walking.
Now, another topic we want to deal with today is handling passengers of reduced mobility. Now, this was highlighted by the Irish Times when they had a complaint from a traveller who was of reduced mobility trying to get assistance which had been booked with Aer Lingus in Paris.
And there were lots of rules going back to this. And in fact, there are two EU regulations. The first one was 1107 of 2006, and that became effective 2 years later. And that was designed to give people of disabled people and persons with reduced mobility some rights in terms of non-discrimination, assistance at the airport and by the airline, provision of information so they knew what to do, and training of the staff. But that mustn't have worked terribly well, because a few years later, we had the EU regulation 2019-2017, and that came in place to make it better, I think, by having passenger-centric designs in airports, improve complaint mechanisms. So obviously it wasn't working in a couple of years, and then transparency about everything that's done. So,
okay, so who's responsible? Is it the airport or the airline?
The answer is yes, to both the airline and the airport. And it breaks down to some extent. The airport should look after all the facilities, you know, physically on the ground, make it easy for people to get through security, through immigration and that kind of thing, and make it easy to get to the actual gate. So the facilities have to be looked after from that point of view.
Now, if you think of airport design, the modern airport design,
yeah,
where you have air bridges, so, and you've got lifts as well as escalators. I'm thinking of Dublin Airport particularly, and
yes,
whether it's Terminal 1 or Terminal 2.
Yeah.
If you are of reduced mobility, you can get anywhere on a lift. And then if you're traveling with particular airlines, you can roll down in a wheelchair basically to the door of the plane on an air bridge.
Yes.
Ryanair don't use air bridges.
Yeah, and I wasn't going to point out Ryanair because I have great time for them, as you know. But I was, yep, in two airports recently, and that thought came to me. One of them was in Memmingham. Again, I was going home in Ryanair. And you walk upstairs to a nice new terminal. I'd done the audit there some years ago. They've improved facilities. It's, you know, not as remote. But you have to walk down the stairs to get to the aircraft. And I couldn't find the lift. Now, I didn't need one, but I said, if person was here, you'd have to go out of the system. And then, you know, I don't know how they'd get the people to, yep, the ramp. Birmingham Airport isn't much different on the common travel area.
I've observed Ryanair aircraft on the tarmac, and they,
yeah,
bring out these mobile,
yes,
kind of buses that lift.
They do.
Up to the door of the aircraft. So they do use those. It's not that they don't provide.
No. They don't. But of course, the low-cost carriers generally say that it's going to interfere with, and it does. The 25-minute turnaround has to be scheduled and rescheduled, and they allow for that if there's two or three people of reduced mobility. And rightly so. As I said, I first came across this, not in the EU, but when I studied under a man called Professor Norman Ashford, the late Norman Ashford. He wrote books on airport engineering and airport operations, and he said he had designed in the USA 30 years ago and more, the Federal regulation said that you must design the airports with 10% of the passengers who have reduced mobility in mind, which was very, I thought, you know, ahead of its time from that regard. It took the EU a long time to get that far. Airlines now, let's talk about that. They're supposed to provide support with boarding and disembarking of the aircraft, and you've seen that and just mentioned it. They must make the seating arrangements on board the aircraft available for PRMs, and that has caused trouble based on some of the TV programmes that we have seen recently. And they must ensure that staff members are trained in assisting PRMs, as we call them. And again, that's been highlighted in the TV programme in the UK, where people were very badly treated by staff who didn't obviously have any training in that regard. And it was a major airline. It wasn't a low-cost carrier from that point of view. So the hand-and-glove relationship between the airports and airlines must be streamlined. The trouble with an airport is you could have perhaps 90 or 100 airlines from different places with different standards. And that's the problem.
There have to be some technological fixes to these deficiencies.
There are, and they're bringing them in, I suppose, by you know, AI is going to help in some regards. But there are mobile apps that you can get now and online platforms. You really have to book your assistance in advance. Yeah. You can't rock up to the airport or the airline and expect the service if they didn't know that you had a disability of some kind. The greatest disability with people is not so much mobility, but it's in fact people who have problems with their sight, you know, who have reduced sight. Because some of the airports have gone to the system where they're quiet now, you know, they're silent. Terminals, they call them, and they really need assistance to get, how do they check in, how do they drop the bags, and how do they get through security? And that takes time and effort, and it can be done. We've got automated systems then again, Pat. You know, believe it or not, I was in San Francisco year before last, and they have automatic wheelchairs. So in other words, you're brought to the wheelchair and you scan your boarding pass, and it will take you to the gate.
To the gate
automatically, so they don't have to have a staff member there. Now, how that works if you get lost, I don't know. And there are other places then which have smart infrastructures, and they've got tactile paving for those who might have, you know, a sight impairment, the better visual signage and other adaptive technologies. So there is important innovations to be done for that point of view. But it's not an even field of playing, I'd say. Some airports are very well engineered and others less so. More modern innovations, you know, put the terminals with that in mind, so you don't have to have too many staircases. You will have lifts where they're required and that kind of thing.
All right. At least the law is on the side of the person who's treated badly. I don't know whether there's any compensation system in place when someone's been abused by an airline.
Indeed
or
not.
By an airport.
But there have been cases, Pat, where people couldn't get onto the aircraft and they've been left behind, and that's quite unacceptable nowadays and quite illegal from that point of view.
Kevin Byrne, retired Lieutenant Colonel, Airport Safety and Security Auditor, thank you very much for joining us. Now,
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.